Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Min Shen. Increasingly, our daily lives are online, especially during the coronavirus shutdown. But access to the internet is not always equal, and the privacy implications of our online lives are sometimes an afterthought. Sasha Meinrapp studies telecommunications policy, cybersecurity, and broadband connectivity. He's the Palmer Chair in Telecommunications at Penn State and the director of XLab, a think tank focusing on the intersection of technology and public policy. He's also the co-founder of the Measurement Lab, an open-source project which collects and provides internet performance data for consumers and researchers. Sasha Meinrapp, welcome to Take Note.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
We're in the midst of COVID-19, and there has been increasing interest in what information technology can do to help mitigate the infectious disease. Using cellular data or even facial recognition to do contact tracing is an idea that's getting a lot of attention and already some investment. How much do we know so far about how effective these methods could be?
Yeah, so the ideal here is to use technology to trace, in essence, the pathways that an infection or a pandemic might take, and then be able to, in essence, intervene across that pathway and thus lessen the public health impacts. That ideal, however, is not borne out by the reality, which is that we don't have good data that any of this is very useful. And on the other hand, we do know for a fact that this is incredibly privacy invasive. Tracking your every move, tracking everyone you come into contact with is almost by definition an invasion of privacy. So what we're being asked to do is to make a trade-off, to say, okay, look, you're going to give up these private areas of your life in order to have this public good, this increased public health outcome. But we don't actually have any information showing that that outcome is real, and therefore that trade-off is worth making. And so that's where we are right now today, is we're being sold, in essence, a result that is not empirically based and is certainly not borne out and is therefore not worth the trade-off.
I'm hearing two points here, which are, one, this method is far from effective, and two, it could open up potential for abuse. So far, some countries like South Korea have tried using technology for contact tracing. What have we learned from those experiments?
Yeah, so South Korea and others have put this into place, and they have found that it is not working, that in essence, not enough people have opted in, that you're getting a lot of false positives. So you can imagine in your everyday life, if you're walking down the street and you're using a mechanism like Bluetooth that in essence can go, yeah, a few feet, but sometimes it can go 50 feet or 100 feet. And therefore everyone that you pass within 50 or 100 feet is a contact. Well, you would get a lot of false positives. A lot of times where people would then be told, oh, like you've come into contact with somebody who's infected, when in fact they may have been a block away from you. That is not helpful diagnostic information. So that has not worked. Here in the United States, we've already had a couple of states, some of whom have paid apparently millions of dollars to utilize some of these contact tracing systems. And what they have found is that, and what they expect is that this only becomes a useful mechanism once you have a critical mass of buy-in, once you have enough saturation of the population. And what they've been saying is around 60% of people need to opt in. And what they're finding is it's about 1% to 2% that have done so. So in that regard, so you then end up with all these huge holes in your data that make it not very useful. I have a lot of questions. I agree with the ideal of the outcome, that we should use technology to enhance public health. I just don't see this being actually efficacious towards that outcome. And instead, what I see it as is incredibly privacy invasive in ways that have profound implications. That these data, once collected, are almost assuredly going to then be abused.
The coronavirus exposed a lot of existing issues in our world. One of them is the lack of accessible and reliable broadband internet across the country. I understand you and your lab have found that the U.S. received slower internet speeds overall during this shutdown. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, so, you know, broadband, cell phone technology, all of these sort of upsides, this liberatory and empowering potential of technology has a very dark side as well, which is that if you're not on the receiving end of all these benefits, then in essence, you're sort of doubly disadvantaged. You know, I can hypothesize about why this problem has grown so substantially, but what our data, looking at tens of millions of broadband speed tests from across the United States, from right before February of 2020 versus right after the stay-at-home orders, so in this case, February versus April 2020, what we see is in many locations in the United States, substantial slowdowns of median speeds. And what this means is that on average, if you will, the 50th percentile of Americans living in many locations in the U.S. are seeing major hits to the speeds that they actually receive in their homes. Now, why that's happening? Well, I think it's definitely because a lot of people are doing telepresence activities, and that's putting strain on the residential networks. That, in fact, when you look at, say, office connections versus home connections, turns out most offices have better connections than your house. And so when you shift, even if we were doing the same kinds of activities in home versus our office, that would put a strain on the network. But the fact that we're doing so much telepresence, which requires a lot of bandwidth, right? Video, live video requires a lot of bandwidth. That's putting even more strain, and that's having a major impact across the U.S. to the point that we're seeing slowdown speeds across the U.S. of around 5 to 10%, which means for every person that's not receiving any slowdown in their speeds, there's somebody that's receiving a very large slowdown to their speeds. And we're in the midst now of investigating who these constituents are that are receiving the worst service post-COVID. And what I can tell you in our preliminary analysis is that it's specific states, it's specific locales, it potentially is even specific internet service providers and certain service provision technologies like wireless networks versus fiber networks, for example, wireless being much more detrimentally impacted than a fiber plant.
Is it fair to ask, shouldn't we have the technical capacity for all of these increased internet usage in this day and age?
Yeah, so if you look historically, the United States was kind of number one on the planet for the first several decades of the internet's development. And in fact, straight through like the early 2000s, really, we were number one. And we could say that and be mostly correct in saying, like, we are the fastest place, we've got the lowest cost, we've got the most ubiquitous connectivity. Like, a lot of great metrics, we were near or the top of the class. And then, starting around 2005, we kind of failed. We had a massive failure. We went from number one to sort of middling amongst highly industrialized nations. That is a remarkable feat of ineptitude over a very short period of time. And what we've seen is that, in essence, other countries, and now a growing list of other countries that are doing far better than the United States, kind of use one of two big levers that they pull. So they either ensure that there is a highly competitive market, that you have many internet service providers to choose from, or they ensure that you have substantial government oversight and corporate accountability to those overseers to provide low-cost, high-speed, ubiquitous connectivity. It's one or the other, either a competitive market space or government oversight. What the U.S. has done, on the other hand, is to, in essence, pretend that we have a highly competitive market space and therefore don't need government oversight. The end result being that we pay more for worse service in fewer locations than a growing list of other countries around the globe. that sounds absurd on the face of it. Why would we pay more for less? But it's sort of this American exceptionalism that cuts across a number of different sectors. Look at healthcare, for example, where we're paying the most on the planet per capita and have some of the worst of at least the highly industrialized nations' health outcomes.
The digital divide has long existed and didn't happen just because of the coronavirus. There are a lot of underlying problems, as you mentioned, including lack of meaningful competition and lack of government oversight. What are some other factors that contribute to this situation as well?
So there's a lot of different factors that are at play here. And it's everything from difficult topology, right? We have a vast country with lots of open spaces, to a hodgepodge of different state rules and regulations and often local rules and, you know, permitting issues and all that. That is both real, but also rather modest in terms of accounting for things. And I can say that because historically, we've always overcome these problems, right? When you look at the telephone network, which is near universal, when you look at the electrical grid, which is near universal, when you look at roads or our education systems, these are all systems that face the same issues as telecommunications in terms of the complexity of the American topology and political sphere. Really, what it comes down to is America just hasn't prioritized this particular infrastructure as mission critical. As mission critical to people no matter where they're living, as mission critical to the health and growth of a thriving economy across the entire United States, as mission critical to education, as mission critical to, in essence, our social and psychological well-being. And as such, we've really deprioritized investment in this infrastructure, and we've deprioritized oversight and accountability over this infrastructure. And so whereas there's lots of reasons that you could point to say, maybe this has an impact or that has an impact, and they all do, but that's all marginal. That's all marginal compared to the need for bold, straightforward, no-nonsense leadership in pushing an agenda that says, hey, universal, affordable connectivity for everyone everywhere has to be our national priority, and now we're going to take it seriously.
There's a lack of transparency in broadband pricing data in the U.S., and I understand you're working on a study to map that information. Can you tell us more about the study? What do you hope to achieve?
Sure. So we've been collecting broadband speed data now for over a decade via the measurementlab.net platform. If you go to Google and type in, you know, broadband speed test into your search bar, a box will appear above your search results that says, you know, do you want to run a speed test? If you click that button, it will run a speed test, and that data will end up in our public repositories, which are used by the scientific and research community to kind of figure out what is actually happening on the internet today. Now, that process of collecting a multitude, millions, tens of millions, and then hundreds of millions of broadband tests is incredibly important. It's necessary, but insufficient to really understanding what's happening when it comes to broadband connectivity in the US. It's very clear, we know this anecdotally for certainty, that there are widely discrepant pricing regimes when it comes to broadband connectivity. We know for sure that people that might be living right next door to each other have wildly different bills for exactly the same service. We know that there is rent seeking amongst a lot of the different realms of broadband service provision, transit, peering, all these other elements that intertwine this fabric that is the internet. And we know that we have almost no transparency of any of this. That as a consumer living almost anywhere in the United States today, if you want to do an apples to apples comparison about what broadband services are available to me and what are their costs. It's like, you should get a PhD if you can figure that out, because it's so darn difficult, needlessly complicated. And I equate this to, imagine if you had to like go buy your groceries, but you had no idea what anything costs, and they would just tell you once you got to the checkout line what your bill is, and you may or may not be charged the same as the person right behind you for exactly the same goods. We would look at that and say, that is an absurd system. But that is what we have with broadband connectivity, that the information is held by the internet service providers and is entirely opaque to us, the broadband consumer. So how can we then make an informed decision? Where is broadband? How much does it cost? Without those two pieces of information, I don't know how you make informed decisions about, for example, how to bridge the digital divide, because you don't even know where it is or what's causing it or the extent. And that's where we are today, that we have, in essence, willfully self-blinded ourselves. And in so doing, have enabled all sorts of business models and practices that have not been in the best interests of consumers. And I look at all of that, taking as a whole, and I say, well, this is probably a suboptimal outcome that we should probably address forthrightly and immediately. And coronavirus just adds kind of fuel to that fire. It adds really kind of a catalyzing agent to say, holy cow, we have to address this problem, because now the detrimental impacts are so plain to see that even without the systematic empirical evidentiary trail, we can't ignore this any longer.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Sasha Meinrath, the Palmer Chair in Telecommunications at Penn State. He's the director of XLab and a co-founder of the Measurement Lab, which collects and provides internet performance data for consumers and researchers. His research focuses on telecommunications policy, cybersecurity, and broadband connectivity. You have done extensive work on telecommunications policies, including privacy and cybersecurity. On May 14th, the Senate voted to reauthorize the USA Freedom Act, which restores our government's surveillance powers and would allow collection of internet search and web browsing data without a warrant. Can you talk about what this means to everyday Americans, and why is this significant, or some would say problematic?
Yeah, so most of us assume that if we're sitting in our house and doing something on our home computer that's private, that surely there's no way that law enforcement would get access to that information. And surely they would not be allowed to get access to that information without getting a warrant. But the reality is that the U.S. government has declared that search histories, that which we look for online, they can grab without a warrant. And they can scoop that up en masse. Now, there are many of us that say, look, that is clearly a search of my private possessions and private information. And at the very least, before I even get into whether you should be doing this in the first place, at the very least, you should have to get a warrant for collecting this kind of private information about what I'm doing inside my house. And weirdly, we are currently amidst a policy battle over whether that is in fact the case. So this is what we know of, this Section 215 of the Patriot Act, which has now been interpreted to mean that law enforcement can collect hundreds of millions of records on U.S. citizens who are completely innocent of doing anything under the guise of searching for terrorists, but now often used for a variety of other law enforcement activities. Doing this without any warrant is problematic. So what's happening right now, we've got a bill that would reauthorize this section of the Patriot Act for data collection, in essence, on the back end. So this would be if you use, you know, Apple products, Google products, Microsoft products, Facebook products, all of these big mega technology company products. The question is, should they then be allowed to share that information or even sell that information to the NSA, to the National Security Agency, to the FBI, to other law enforcement agencies? And I would argue no. I would argue that that private information is private, first and foremost, and that the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, protecting against unlawful searches and seizures, which declares explicitly and without any caveats that you must get a warrant to execute a search on your private lives. But we are now battling over how, in essence, the rules of the road should look when it comes to reauthorizing this. So one of the amendments to this bill that did pass is, in essence, saying, look, when you go to a secret court, like the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court, the FISA court, and under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court, you collect domestic intelligence, that if you're the FBI, an FBI that has, by the Attorney General of the United States, or sorry, the Inspector General of the United States, been found to have lied to this court, that it's probably good to have a defendant in that courtroom as well. That it shouldn't just be the FBI presenting to a judge saying, we need this information in a secret court, that there should be some advocate standing up for the rights of individuals beyond on the other side of that ruling. Somehow that has become a fairly radical position in DC. So Section 215 was used because law enforcement said, without this, in essence, terrorists will run rampant and et cetera. And so there's been a series of hearings where the FBI and others have been asked under oath, how many terrorists did this catch? And what we're finding time and time and time again is, in fact, these are not very efficacious programs at all. That again, the trade-off, just like contact tracing, that we're told you're going to give up this privacy, in this case, your web browsing histories and et cetera, and by doing so, you will enable us to catch terrorists. As far as we can tell from the public evidence, is that these are highly ineffective programs. That trade-off that we're promised, you give up privacy, you get safety. In fact, we don't get the safety. We've just given up our privacy. And, you know, my argument, again, has always been like, we should follow the data. So if we have a program of this sort, we should mandate that we collect information about the false positives. How many people did we wrongfully label as terrorists? And we should be looking at the false negatives. How many terrorists did we miss with this program? These are the kinds of questions that I feel like, again, applying scientific method to evaluating how effective a surveillance program is, how effective a public health initiative is. It's just smart. It's what we should be doing. And yet when it comes to the application of these newfangled digital technologies, we just throw out things like science, like empirically backed decision-making, like informed decision-making. And I think we need to bring that back to the forefront of these debates.
What do you say to people who understand these problems and want to make the situation better, but feel there's no way to opt out of a digital life?
Yeah, this is the challenge of our era. But the idea that this is more entrenched or more difficult to solve than, let's say, the civil rights movement, women enfranchisement, the end of slavery, the elimination of our British overlords, right? Like, America is steeped in, born of, a revolutionary zeal for freedom, for, in essence, our individual civil liberties. This is just the digital era battle that has to be fought. Now, I'm an optimist. I think we fight and we win. It doesn't mean it's going to be easy. In fact, far from it. But I actually think, looking historically, this is an easier battle to win than many of the battles that we have fought and successfully at least moved the ball forward on. And so, you know, what do I tell people that feel like there's a lot here and it's a very difficult battle and they feel a little hopeless or helpless to effect meaningful change? I would say, I hear you. It is true. This is a battle for our times, and it's going to be a long slog, and it's going to be demoralizing, and it's going to be difficult. But it's a surmountable problem. And it's one that as more and more individuals start talking about, hey, this happened to you, this happened to me. I'm not comfortable with this process, that program, this invasion, any more than you are. As we have these conversations more publicly, it builds pressure. And by doing that, maybe not this month, this year, but by doing that over the course of the next generation, we can affect, and we will affect, major societal changes. We'll create, in essence, a new normative framework of what's acceptable and not acceptable within this digital era. And that's what I and many, many other folks working in D.C., that's what we're fighting for. That we truly and honestly believe this is a winnable battle, and that it will take a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, frankly. But that we get there, the more that we're able to talk about this and to normalize the questioning of these practices and programs that have, in essence, a PR promise that's never delivered and a trade-off that has been so detrimental to so many.
Sasha Meinrath, thank you for joining us on Take Note.
Been my pleasure. Thank you.
Sasha Meinrath is the Palmer Chair in Telecommunications at Penn State and the director of XLab, a think tank focusing on the intersection of technology and public policy. He is also a co-founder of the Measurement Lab, an open-source project which collects and provides internet performance data for consumers and researchers. His research focuses on telecommunications policy, cybersecurity, and broadband connectivity. You can listen to more Take Note interviews on wpsu.org/take note. I'm Min Shan, WPSU.